This is Joe McMillan.
And I'm interviewing Sam Martin, a veteran of the racetrack, now retired. And we're talking about his experiences on the racetrack. And this is November 7, 1994. Good afternoon, Sam. I'm here today to ask you a few questions about your experiences around the racetrack and on the racetrack. And you are one of my favorites, a person who's worked on the track a long time. How long did you work on the racetrack?
35 years.
35 years. And which stables did you work for?
I started out working on the racetrack right here for Brown Hotel Stables. At that time, it was trained by a man named John C. Howe. He was from Covington, Kentucky.
Mm-hmm. Where were you born? And give us a little history about where you're from. And
I was born and raised in Pulaski, Tennessee, on the Milky Way Farms. They owned the classical stable horses in that time. And I went into the military service from there. I became a cowboy. Went to Phoenix in Springville, Arizona.
How old were you?
I was 17. They sold the farm in Pulaski and moved to Springville in Phoenix, Arizona with a Hereford herd. And it was owned and operated by Mrs. Mars' son-in-law, whom previously owned the Milky Way farm. His name was Alan Feeney, and had the best Hereford herd in the world. I went from there to the military service.
What about your family? Do you have brothers and sisters?
Yeah, my father, he worked for the Milky Way farm until he was deceased in 1945. My brother worked with the racing stable at Milky Way, and he left there in 1935 and went to Santa Anita, California. Mm-hmm. And they raced the circuit from Santa Anita to Belmont Park in New York, to Hot Springs, Arkansas, and back to Louisville. That was their circuit. They dispersed that stable in 1942. And he came to Louisville out of the service.
Your mother still lives, does she?
No, my mother and father are both are deceased. My mother, she died at the age of 40.
Uh-huh. You had just one brother then?
I have three brothers.
Three brothers?
And one sister.
And a sister. Are they living?
Yes, my older brother lives in Nashville. He's 79 years old. His birthday was 12th of this month. My brother that preceded me to the racetrack. He lives in York, Pennsylvania.
He's retired, of course.
Yeah, he's retired. He was an assistant trainer for Mr. J.H. Pierce, 35 years.
So then once you, did you go to school in and around Milky Way?
Yeah, I went to grade school in a little community near Milky Way called Haywood. And I finished there and went to high school and dropped off my junior year.
Where'd you go to high school? In the same area?
In Pulaski.
In Pulaski,
yeah.
Was these segregated schools at that time?
Yes, they were segregated schools.
Yeah. Do you remember your grandparents?
No, I don't remember either.
Neither of the grandparents. Yeah. But so you just were sort of like raised up on the farm, on Milky Way Farm, right? Born and raised on the farm, right?
I went from there to Arizona and worked on the ranches there.
So you just sort of naturally gravitated to horses, right? So then when you went to the service, how old were you then?
20.
About 20, yeah. You had been out in the West as a cowboy, right?
Cowboy.
What did you do as a cowboy? I mean, what kind of things? What was your daily line of work?
We kept the records. It was a registered herd, so we consequently kept the records for breeding certifications. We branded, we tattooed, we did everything that a working cowboy does. And then we, in the fall, we always went on the circuit with the show herd,
mm-hmm.
because that's where the money is made. The same as racehorse sales, they have Hereford sales. Then I came out of service and was unemployed. My brother talked me into coming to the racetrack.
And when you came to the racetrack, where'd you come?
Right here in Louisville.
Here in Louisville. Yeah. Right. And you came with the Brown Hotel stable.
Brown Hotel stable.
And that trainer, as you say, was
John C. Howe, as I recall. I think he was.
And that would have been in the 50s.
1955. February 1955, I came to
Nashville. So from February 1955 until you retired
June.
You worked straight on the racetrack, or was there any interruption?
Well, I took a hiatus and went to work for International Harvest, I think, for about a year. Over there on Crittenden Drive.
Right.
And I left there and went to work for DuPont, and DuPont closed, I think, about a year after I was there, at Charleston and then.
Yeah.
Unemployed again.
Back to the racetrack again.
I worked for American Standard in between.
Okay.
And I left there and back to the racetrack again. I worked for a local man named Sam Bryant Ott. And I worked for him about 2 years, I think. And then I went to work for a man who was 25 years assistant to Sonny Jim Fitzsimmons. And I worked for him 12 years.
Who was he?
J.H. Pierce Sr. and Junior.
Slim Pierce. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then I left him at Saratoga in 1968, and I stayed in New York until this June, past June.
And while you were in New York, you worked for several stables then, right?
Yeah, while in New York, I worked for his son-in-law for a while, Warren Pascuma. Then I went to work for Rokeby from 1970 until 75. Had a serious automobile accident, took a hiatus, and went to work for Alfred Vanderbilt and C.B. Whitney. And I stayed there until they both reduced their sale and subsequently dispersed. And then I went to work for Green Tree Stables. And Green Tree went public. And then I came back to Rookery and worked for them from 1990 until 1994.
What kind of jobs did you hold on the racetrack?
I was groom, foreman about four times for four different outfits. Assistant trainer for J.H. Pierce. Assistant trainer for Warren Pascuma. Foreman for Green Tree and foreman for Rookery Stables.
Yeah, you've had a wealth of experience there. Did you, when you worked here for Brian Ott, that you said you, when you came back, you worked for
Brian
S. Brian Ott. Were you a groom at that time?
Yes. Or,
Were you ever a hot walker?
I was never a hot walker.
Never a hot walker.
Never.
Always a groom, right?
The first day I came on the racetrack, they hired me as a groom at Brown Hotel.
Yeah, but and did you have to have an experience? Had you already groomed before?
No, I had no experience.
So how'd you learn to groom?
I just watched my brother.
By watching?
Whom I thought was as knowledgeable horseman as I ever met. He could do anything for it.
So you learned it by just watching, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And so when you took the job as groom, you already knew how to groom then, right? It wasn't, you weren't any... You didn't have to go through an apprenticeship or anything like that.
Yes, I did, because when the first when first hired on the Rico. I didn't know anything about a Rico.
Yeah. Because they're different from Herefords, right?
Oh yeah, they're different from any other breed, actually. I just watched my brother and consequently I learned it.
I see.
Because I said he could do anything well with the resources, and he was meticulous.
Now, in your experiences with all these different stables, I'm sure you saw some great horses and also some great people, and you saw some good and the bad. Talk a little bit about your experiences here with Brian Ott, and then also when you went to New York and worked with all those various stables. Those are some of the top stables in the world, Vanderbilt, and Stevie Whitney, and Green Tree, and all those. Calumet.
Calumet, and you had Aladar and Debona Dale, and Before Dawn, and three Eclipse winning fillies, and Aladar that we had there then. I've enjoyed every minute in this business. Most of them through the love of horses, but I met a lot of nice people. A lot of classical people. And when you are fortunate enough to do that, to work with all those classical horses and people with a lot of class, you miss it tremendously. Because the game has changed a lot. It's changed an awful lot since the time when I first started. You don't find as many people dedicated to the horse racing business as you did when I first started. Speaking in terms of them going on the back stretch.
Mm-hmm.
It involves long hours, a lot of hard work, and you got another game to be dedicated to.
So even with Green Tree and all those, were you groomed in? But you said foreman also. Tell us a little bit about the role of a foreman, how that differs from assistant trainer.
A foreman is a person who he makes the preparation for the daily routine of the training. He gets the horses ready, he administers medication, see that they're prepared for every set. Usually you have three sets of horses go to the track for their training routine, and he's responsible. First thing he does in the morning when he comes to work is check with the night watchman and see if anything has occurred abnormal, any horses sick or anything, and the foreman always takes every horse's temperature before he goes into training that day.
How do you take his temperature?
You have a thermometer, and it's a rectal thermometer.
Okay.
You take a horse's normal temperature is about 100.25.
And so it's got to be somewhere in that plus or minus
that
1 or 2 degrees,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
From that, if it's up like 105 or 110, that means he's having problems, right?
Yeah.
Then what do you do if he gets problems? It's the foreman's job then to report that to
the veterinarian. Report to the assistant trainer, and he
is in the hierarchy. Would the foreman be just under the assistant trainer?
Just under the assistant trainer.
I see. That usually only works out with the big stables, though, right? And usually work with only big stables,
big
right?
Stables, yeah.
Green Tree was big.
Big.
How many horses would you have a stable like Green Tree?
On the average, we have like 27, from 27 to 40. You'd have like 40 in the wintertime because we'd pick up the yearlings to train. And that would be about 20 horses in addition to the 27 that you have.
Mm-hmm. Then the assistant trainer then reported to the trainer, right? So that's the hierarchy,
sure.
Right? So the foreman's then got a really big job. And that's
sure. And the foreman, in addition to checking the physical being of the horse you check with the night watchman, see if anyone has gotten cast at night. By being cast means that he's laying down to roll in his stall, and consequently have got up against a wall or something, then whereas he can't maneuver enough to get himself up.
I see.
Which is a dangerous thing. They can break an ankle or whatever.
That's really, so then you got to really check that every day. That's an everyday thing, right? Does it, you have anything to do with the feeding?
Yeah. Woman always puts the feed out, and it's a mixture of feed, and he has to know what volume to feed him.
Mm-hmm.
And that's done 3 times a day. And the big stables, the night watchmen always feed them in the morning, the breakfast.
I see.
Foreman attends to the lunch feeding and the evening feeding with his dinner.
Uh-huh. Was that the biggest stable you worked for, Green Tree, or was Rope Tree bigger than Green Tree? Or any of the others?
They were about the same.
All about the same. Did they have various branches of these stables? I mean, you'd have one group here and another group at another track somewhere, or just... Would that be all that they
all
would have
in training? All those stables that I, with the exception of Calumet, had horses in Europe.
I see.
You'd have a division in Europe and a division. The larger division would always be there.
Okay. Of all of the experiences that you had on the racetrack, what was the greatest one that you ever had?
Winning the Kentucky Derby.
Yeah, I'd like for you to talk a little bit about that and how that all came about. That was with Sea Hero, right?
Sea Hero, yeah.
1992.
1993.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Sea Hero, we always thought that he had some of the classical ability and shipped him to Florida. And he didn't seem to like Florida. He didn't seem to like the Florida weather. And he didn't run up to the trainer's expectations, so he decided maybe he'd enjoy himself more if he brought him back to Aiken, South Carolina, where we always trained our horses in the wintertime. Gotta give him a vacation for the winter, so we brought him back there.
So Rokeby had an outlet in Aiken, South Carolina?
Yeah, we always had a training center down there.
Oh, I see. So they would send all of their horses, or just some of their horses?
All of our horses went to Aiken every winter.
And how long would they winter?
From November 28th until usually around April 15th or 1st of May.
Is that right? So you never raced in the winter races?
We didn't race in the winter at all.
Didn't go to Florida?
Well, that was a special horse like that when you send it to Florida to prep for the Derby.
So you'd send them from Aiken down
to Florida?
To Florida, right. Okay.
But he didn't do well down there. Mr. Miller thought that he'd probably like being back in Aiken. And he was right, because the first 2 days that he arrived from Florida back to Aiken, you could tell that he loved being back there. And he seemed to thrive. You could just look at him and tell him that he was doing well. And we shipped from Aiken to Keeneland to prepare for the Derby, and he seemed to do better every single day. He showed us that he was doing really well, and he wrote us to be in there. We ran him in Bluegrass, and he encountered a tremendous amount of trouble, I thought, from what I'd discerned, and he finished fourth. And I thought, as a result of all the trouble that he got into in the Bluegrass, he deserved a chance to come to compete for the Derby, and all the time preceding the Derby, where I stood, what I discerned, I thought that he had a big chance to win the Derby. And 3 days preceding the Derby, I didn't think it was a possible chance to beat him, barring any trouble that he might encounter. And I'll never forget when we just preceding the Derby, all the horses had gone on the track. We were watching a monitor there in the winner's circle. But a group stood in front of the monitor, and we had no view after that. And I heard him call his name coming down the stretch and said he came through an opening, and they moved away from it, and I saw it when he passed. Grandest feeling ever. It's such an exhilarating feeling. It's just indescribable. I knew I was the last cry, and I did both. But there's one feeling that I will never ever forget. It compromises all the other things that didn't happen. And it's such a joyful feeling to predicted that so long and have it to prevail.
And to have it prevail in the waning years of your career.
Yeah.
I'm sure that has a lot to do with the way you feel about racing.
That was the highlight of my whole career.
Tell us a little bit about some of the people you said you met. I'm sure there are all kinds of people that work on the track, and you have all kinds of people who work as hot walkers and grooms. And tell us a little bit about the changes in the kinds of people that you see around the track now. In terms of help, I'm talking now, not the owners and trainers. We'll get to those later, but talk a little bit about the laborers, grooms, and people who just work on the track and the differences and changes that have taken place over your 35 years on the track.
When I first came around, the people who worked on the backside, the people who, the grooms, the hot walkers, the exercise boys, the foremen, were people who had a lifetime dedication. They loved the horse. That's the reason that they came around. And most people in those days followed some member of their family to the racetrack.
Mm-hmm.
They were very, very dependable. They loved the horse, and you could trust to do whatever they had to do, you could trust them. It was a joy to be around them. They were competitive. No one person would let the other one outdo him when it came to caring for the race. They had a lot of pride in what they did. As opposed to now, people come to the racetrack, most of them has no knowledge of what the racehorse industry is about. They just come to the racetrack, and it seems to me that they don't have as much care. It seems to me it's just from payday to payday.
Right, so
which is very unfortunate.
So there's a kind of like an itinerant person who does that now.
Yeah.
There's not the stability is not there. So in the past, when did you see that take place, the changes start taking place? Where are you?
I'd say in the late 70s. It was very distinct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Was that the way it was in New York?
I think it's universal.
It's universal.
Yeah.
So what you're saying, the people who are coming in now are not as stable. They come in, they go, and they're very transient type.
Sure.
Things.
And I think the result of that is it's not much to attract them. Living conditions, wages. I think if you had better living conditions and better wages, a living wage, I think it would attract a better caliber of people.
Yeah. How do you
view, give them a lot more incentive?
How do you view the contributions of blacks to horse racing over time?
I think it's been a tremendous contribution. At one time, the backstretch personnel comprised of mostly blacks. Whereas now, it's very few. I've seen more in Louisville than I've seen throughout the United States. Whereas before, it's about all yourself.
Do you ever know any black trainers?
Yeah. I guess two of the best trainers I ever saw were black.
Who were they?
Clifford Scott. He raced in the Midwest in New Orleans in the wintertime. He raced in Chicago and New Orleans. That was his itinerary. Yeah, I'm sure that was solely his itinerary. Those two places. Chester Ross in New York was as good a horseman as I ever saw.
Did they have big stables or small?
Yeah, Clifford Scott has a stable that comprised of maybe 20-25 horses on an average, and he owned 50% of all of them.
So he owned them also. Yeah.
Chester Ross trained for the richest man in racing in New York and won a lot of races for him. Seymour Cohen, he's on the 10 mm-hmm. richest men in the United States.
What happened to them?
Chester Ross is, well, they're both now deceased.
Mm-hmm.
Chester Ross died 2 years ago, and Clifford Scott died about 2 years ago. As I recall, I read an article in one of the equine magazines about Clifford Scott. They had a profile in there. He trained horses 50 years without a suspicion.
50 years without a suspicion. No infractions of the rule whatsoever. That's great. And had a good record then, too.
Yeah.
What about the others, grooms and assistant trainers? And do you see, were there great blacks in those jobs also?
Oh, yes.
Some of the better ones?
Johnny Whittingham's foreman, he's now retired, he's about 85 now. He's been with Charlie 40 years. One of the best horsemen.
What was his name?
Edward Lambert.
Ed Lambert, yeah.
Oh, I can think of numerous more horsemen that were foreman since he came.
There's been some controversy about African Americans in horse racing. I know there's been a lot of hullabaloo as of late about trainers and jockeys and the disappearance of jockeys and the demise of trainers. Talk a little bit about that. I know if you've seen, there haven't been any black jockeys to speak of, although there have been a few here and there. But what do you think about the why the demise of the black jockey and trainer in horse racing?
There's a tremendous amount of money that can be made riding now. A tremendous amount of money can be made training. I think it's become it's gotten to the point where it's very clannish now, as a result of the tremendous amount of money to be made. For an example, in the future, with very little money, blacks dominated this game. And then came the time where you could make a tremendous amount of money, unheard of amount of money. Their chances diminished.
Yeah. That's kind of like the pervasive kind of discrimination that goes on in the whole society. It affected the racetrack also.
Yes.
And probably even more so. Because there were, did you see any organized labor groups in horse racing, like unions or anything?
Yes.
Or any attempt to unionize?
Oh, yes, it was attempted in New York about three times, I think.
What happened?
Nothing ever became of it. I don't know what the ultimate reason was. There's some obstacles that I guess that would prevent that even happening. First thing, I think there shouldn't be any place on a racetrack for the backstride personnel to live. Because you can't very well refuse to work and live on a man's premises.
So that usually that's what happens, isn't it? That they provide,
yeah.
they live in on the quarters, right? Yeah.
In
the tack rooms right around the horses, right?
I think it's a basic reason for not having a higher class. Degree of personality, because if you allow a person to live on any premises on his own, rent free, it becomes sanctuary for misfits on the streets.
Yeah. In other words, the homeless sort of gravitate to that.
Sure.
So you pick it up.
Sure.
Itinerant, sure. Transient types, because they provide a place to live.
Sure. Yeah.
And not always are those people the best people that you would want to work with horses.
No. Yeah. A person of a higher caliber, of a higher class, is not going to live under those conditions anyway.
How the condition? How would you describe the conditions, the living conditions on the backside?
From what I've seen, most of them are deplorable. I guess the best ones that I've seen in recent years has been a Calder, where they're supervised, inspected every day.
Mm-hmm.
But if the person is going to live in an uncontrolled condition, the rent-free is not going to keep them up.
And that usually happens. Did you ever live on the backside when you were working?
Yeah.
Earlier?
Sure, just recently.
Recently,
yeah. New York.
You had your own apartment, yeah, and all that. Right? But there are some good spots in.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
But generally speaking, it's the conditions aren't very good.
No.
Showers.
No.
Hot water.
You think right here. There might be 3 shower buildings, half the size of the living room.
Is that right?
On the entire racetrack.
Is that right? So in other words, if you work on the track, and that is a dirty job too, you only got, it's a common shower there.
Sure.
For folk there. Yeah.
Then you have to walk through it with the bathroom on, you know.
And sometimes it's cold, and yeah, so you.
And they were in remote areas, and they're not immediately available to you.
And that's even at the good tracks then, right?
Well, here.
Here at Churchill Downs.
In New York, they have cottages, and they all have from 1 to 2 showers in that building.
I see. So in New York, it's a little bit better. All the tracks in New York, Aqueduct, Belmont, Saratoga, all of them, a little better kept up, and the living conditions are a little bit better, is what you're saying.
Yeah.
And the farther you get out in the country then, the worse the conditions. Yeah. Did you ever go to California?
Yeah.
Stay for any time on the race?
Well,
on the
race. I saw from 1984 until now, Hollywood Park probably has the best living conditions.
Of all of them?
Yeah. Air conditioning, heat. Santa Anita's okay. Hot Springs.
Hot Springs is okay.
Yeah. Yeah. What I think you should do here is build some dormitory someplace.
I see. And that, then if you had a dormitory, then people can live in a dormitory. And then they can go back and forth.
I don't believe that people live in a bar.
Yeah. What about recreation and recreational facilities?
Yeah, I just sometimes think that's a bad too. It's because it confines them within that premises.
I see.
And subsequently, it creates an atmosphere where they're more, getting more or less uncivilized. You know, they can't cope with the average person.
Mm-hmm. In other words, it's almost like quarantining.
Yeah.
They, if you provide the recreation activities.
It's Five Dollar Park. They got a big place there for recreation. It just seems to me, any city that's surrounded by any racetrack that's surrounded by a city, I don't think there's any need for a recreational facility, because it confines them right within the perimeter where they work.
Right.
And if it's ever...
So it becomes sort of like a prison then.
Yeah, if there is a need for you to socialize with the person outside, sometimes difficult to do.
Thought that having recreational facilities on the backside were confining, and I hadn't ever heard that point of view before, but I see it clearly that it would be confining. But what would happen if you didn't, I mean, are people clamoring for more recreational facilities on the backside, or the people who work there, do they want more, or do the owners and trainers want more? What's the situation regarding rec facilities? I noticed over here they built a wet rec room.
Yes, I that's what I was speaking in reference to, the rec rooms. As far as the baseball fields and other buildings for recreation, I have no qualms with that, but the buildings per se that all you can do is play ping pong, cards, and whatnot, I think that confines a person.
I see.
And it kind of alienates him from the people outside of his perimeter where he works.
I see that.
I sometimes think if that was not available, they would go outside more and in the community, and be able to cope with the community. I think it's the longer you stay inside on the backstretch where you work daily, I think you become more alienated from the population.
Do you think that also the living conditions and traveling and all that has an impact on family life? And if so, what impact on family life?
Sure, I think it has a big impact on family life, especially if you're raising young kids. You're away from them so long a period that they sometimes forget who you are. You are not there to discipline. And I think it has a big impact on it, speaking in reference to keeping a family together. I think it's virtually impossible.
Yeah. It's worse in the army, in the military, in some ways, right? Because you got to be always moving around from place to place. And then, of course, the family can't live on the backside with you. If you got a family, you got to live in town somewhere, right?
And even the period that you are at home, you are away 7 days a week at that.
That all day?
On the average, yeah.
Yeah, every day, 7 days a week.
7 days a week.
How many hours generally, average hours you put in? Say as a groom, a good groom that really cares about the horses and all, a good foreman.
16 at least.
16 hours a day. And when do you get time for anything then?
When you finish work in the evening, it's having dinner in the bed. There's some outfits, like in New York, you work 5.5 days. And they have a stipulation from the starting time in the morning is 6 o'clock. And from 6 o'clock to like 4:30, That's not always true.
I see. So you really don't get paid.
You have to go to work before 6 o'clock, at least an hour, to prepare your horses for training.
What about the pay? Do you think it's equitable? You know,
if it is, I think it would be confined to New York alone.
I see. As far as the pay for working a general job on the racetrack as compared outside, is the pay compatible?
I think the pay is adequate, speaking in terms of your physical work, your physical labor. But in terms of hour, I think it's inadequate.
So you put more hours in, you may not be putting as much physical energy into it, but you make up for that in terms of hours, right? Is that for everybody, or is that just for the people who take care of the horses? Exercise boys don't have that problem, do they?
No, they work from 6 to 11.
Right.
On an average.
Right. Do exercise boys generally make more than groom?
Yes.
They do?
Yes.
And is their pay governed by the trainer?
It's governed by the trainer.
Yes. He pays them what he wants to pay them, right?
Sure.
What he can get them for, rather.
Yes. Yeah.
And do usually, in your work, did you usually use the same exercise boys, or did you just...
Yeah, same exercise. We used to carry like 12.
You'd carry 12, right? So you have the same ones all the time.
Same ones.
And they would always work the same horses. So they would know the horses that they worked with. Do jockeys exercise?
If you have one for a special workout,
I see.
You would
bring the jockey out. And the jockey would then get a chance to know the horse.
Sure.
Does that work pretty good sometimes?
Yeah, it does.
When C. Hero ran the Derby, did he have a regular exercise boy? And
sure.
Jockey work?
The jockey, Jerry Bailey, and he directed a regular exercise person.
And so Jerry would work him before the race and got to know him.
Sure.
Then, right?
Sure.
Did he ride him as a 2-year-old, Bailey?
Jerry rode him as a 2-year-old.
Yeah, so Jerry knew him then.
Jerry knew him.
So that works well if you got a special race and then you move the jockey into it. Tell me a little bit about the appearance of women and illegal aliens on the racetrack. When did that start taking place, and how do you see that impacting working relationships and conditions on the backside?
As I recall, the trend of women on the racetrack, it began about 1965 or something. That's my recollection is about that year. I think they came and made a good impact on racing because they're persons who love horses. They will work relentlessly with a horse. Hours don't mean anything to them. They're very reliable. I'm not in favor of illegal aliens in any aspect, but I will say they're very dependent too. They're very, very reliable. They love their horses. And they never waver. But when speaking in terms of illegality, I'm not for it at all in any aspect.
Okay. Yeah, but if they come, they do work then, right? And
they
work.
Come, they earn, they deserve what they do. They, whatever they earn, they deserve.
Yeah, and they really put their hearts and souls into the
industry. Totally reliable.
That's great. Talk a little bit about what you see as the future of horse racing. With your vast knowledge of the game, How do you see it going?
I would hope that it would be as good or better than it has been. But in the foreseeable future, I don't think it will be as good as it has been, my honest opinion, personal opinion. Because I think the state legislature in almost every state is not favorable. It's not conducive to good racing.
I think that they're more compatible to the government. I think they take too much taxes. And they consequently don't attract new owners as a result of that. Mr. Duchessois in Chicago is talking about closing his track as a result of it. He wants to license for the Ribbon Boat Gambling on the premises, and nobody wants to do that. The legislature is not favorable towards it. And if he closes that facility, which I think he will, I think it's very serious, it'd be very detrimental to the community.
So you're saying, what you're saying is that with the impact of other gambling, racing could be in trouble. Yeah. What about the impact of the simulcast?
I think that's the only thing that will save it.
So do you see fewer tracks in the future or more tracks? I see there have been lots of new tracks have been built. There's one in Houston, there was one up in Minnesota that closed.
Yeah.
Birmingham, lots of places they've been building tracks.
Sure.
What do you see as happening, say, by the year 2001, the beginning of the next century, where will horse racing go? Fewer tracks, more simulcast, more other kinds of gambling?
I think it will be more other kinds of gambling.
On the premises of the racetrack?
Yes. That's the only way that I can see that racing will survive in the foreseeable future. Because if they're outside of the racing for Maryland, they will attract the equal number or more than the racetrack itself will. But it's very unfortunate. But that's my first opinion.
Mm-hmm. What do you see of the future of blacks in racing? I noticed that we've had various blacks to get into racing. Generally, the people who have the money, the Hammers and the Gordys and a few of them. How do you see that whole thing unfolding?
I don't see much future for that, because it just seems to me that the number of blacks that I've seen in racing, I think they come into racing expecting to make an enormous amount of money, and that's virtually impossible. When that doesn't prevail, they seem to drop out immediately. That's a bit very, very sad thing, too.
Yeah. So that's like Hammer. You don't hear much about him anymore. He was in. It's like a flash in the pan. Is that what you're saying?
Sure.
And so it looks good. It looks glamorous, and they want to make the quick fix, quick buck, quickly. But it's not that way.
I think Barry Gordy is a person more knowledgeable about the equine industry than any black that has been in the game.
At the owner level.
As an owner, yeah. But it's it's very unfortunate that he's not any bigger than he is.
I've often had the attitude about these people who have money, like the athletes and the entertainers and people who have that, who come into the game and don't make use of people who are at the lower level, like yourself and others around Lexington and Louisville, who really know the game, but they go towards people who they think are knowledgeable, many of them white, and they get snafu'd as a result of that. Do you think that's a good hypothesis?
Yes, and I think the reason that it doesn't prevail is because it's socially unpopular. I'm almost sure that's the reason. Mm-hmm. That's another thing that makes me very sad about it.
Yeah. So you don't see blacks really coming in, making, having a great impact on the industry in the foreseeable future then?
No, I don't.
Yeah. It'd be like the hammer phenomenon then.
That's what I believe, yeah.
Yeah.
From where I stand, that's what I see.
But it could be, though. If they would organize and really understand and understand the nature of the game, that this is a long-term kind of thing. And being the sport of kings that it is, and with all the money that it is that's in it, if they would come in some organized fashion into the game, there's money to be made, right?
Sure.
But like many other things, we don't always come in the right way, right? Yeah.
Unfortunate, but this is what I see. If us blacks are not raised immediately around football or basketball or racehorses, whatever we are not immediately raised around, we don't have no interest in it. I think it's very unfortunate, very sad.
Yeah.
From where I stand, the way I see it, it's not because I was raised around horses. It's because that I was raised around horses as a result of me loving this game so much. But I wasn't raised around hockey either, but I'd like to know something about it, or golf, or whatever it is. I'm not going to let anything happen around me that I don't seek some information.
Yeah, because you're inquisitive.
Sure.
That's right. Curious enough to find out. And sometimes people are not like that. Many of the people who gravitate towards horse racing are not like that. They don't have those kinds of minds that look around and see the whole picture.
Sure. You got it.
Yeah. Yeah.
You got it, because your social life can't be confined to the backside of racing.
That's right. If it becomes that, then you get straitjacketed.
If it becomes that, then you got to be antisocial when you come out of there.
That's right. That's right. You just be horse, only horse, horse. Right.
And there's not many people, there's not that many people that's horse over you.
That's right. Tell me a little bit about the people at the owner level. I know you have had contact with people like Mr. Mellon. And you know people of that ilk. What kind of people are these people? The people who own the big stables and who really make racing what it really is, the sport of kings. What kind of people are these people?
They are the people with the utmost class, compassion for the human being and the racehorse. The people that I've known in that capacity. Tremendous amount of class. Mr. Mellon, Mr. Vanderbilt, Mr. Whitney, Mrs.
Markey.
Mrs. Markey.
Yeah.
All of those people have been people of the highest caliber, people with compassion, respect for the human being, no matter what level. And I think that's at least 75% of my reason for staying the game so long. I've been very fortunate. Not everybody's been as fortunate as I have to been able to work with those kind of people. And I don't foresee people of that caliber ever being around again.
You see them dying, they're going away from the horse industry. They're vanishing. Class type owners, so the old money in horse racing is disappearing. Is what you're saying? What about the impact of the foreigners on horse racing? You've looked at that. I'm sure you've looked at that. The sales to the Arabs and Japanese and other people who come in regularly and buy the stock. What's the impact on American horse racing?
It's a big impact because it seems in this era they're among the few people that can afford to sustain racing. They have that kind of money. They have the reservoir of money to put into this game. But I think it's very sad that they have come over here, the Japanese, Arabs, and dominated the market. And subsequently had most of the royal blood, the royal equine blood, has taken it back to Europe and the Far East. I think Mr. Will Ferris has made a real good gesture. It seems to me that he's trying to buy the studs that's retiring with the blue blood, and he's buying those or syndicating or whatever and taking them to his ranch to stand them as sires. I think he's trying to keep that blood back in America. You know, he's trying to stop that flow to Europe and the Far East.
Yeah. That leads me to the Breeders' Cup. I know we just watched the Breeders' Cup this past weekend, and I thought it was a great Breeders' Cup. But the impact of the Breeders' Cup on that phenomenon, what do you see? Is that having any impact at all? That is to get people interested at the breeding level to be sure that these people who are Americans keep some of that blood that's been going away from here the last 20 years.
Oh, sure.
in this country.
Sure. I think the Breeders' Cup is just a marvelous show. A projection of the equine industry to enlighten people in America what horse racing is about. If anything saves horse racing, it will be the Breeders' Cup Foundation.
Yeah. I noticed the other day with the simulcasting and all the total handle of the Breeders' Cup was something like $35 million. At the racetrack at Churchill Downs, it was
11.
A little bit over 11 million. And, you know, I always look at the handles of these various racetracks and sort of gauge the economic conditions according to that. It looks like things are in pretty good shape there.
Sure.
The
a big economical impact.
On this country.
On this country, yeah.
Sure. And, you know, that leads me to the question about people and gambling, you know, and there are a lot of people who have the radical right and other folks who argue against racing. And I had in my own career, a controversy here in this community about Sunday racing and all. What's your view about that? About horse racing in general, and the impact of horse racing on the value system of this country?
If you're economically aware, you'd be foolish to argue, if not for, the racing industry, because it has such an economical impact, and it would really be in trouble without it.
That's right, especially in Kentucky, right?
Sure.
Where we already have an attack on tobacco and liquor, those two commodities that were big industry in Kentucky now. And if there came a concomitant attack on horse racing, the state would be in trouble.
In trouble.
Big trouble. Yeah. Sam, it's been good talking to you about your career and all, but I want you to just close out by talking a little bit about your whole career and some of the great things that have had, other than the Derby. I know you talked about Sea Eagle and stuff, but great horses and great moments and you bowing out and all of that and how you feel about it. You just sort of close out with that.
I think the Derby. I think it was a gift from God to close out my career with the Derby, because I've been in 35 years and nothing. I've had a lot of great moments in racing, but nothing like this had ever happened to me. I enjoyed every single moment in racing, and the reason is, I guess, utmost reason is that I met so many nice people in this. And I worked with some really nice trainers. And it's been very gratifying for me to work, excuse me, for those type of people. I had a lot of respect for them. They had a lot of respect for me. That thing alone has been very important.
I'm sure.
For me.
Why did you have to bow? Is it because of your health?
Health reasons. I thought that when I did.
How old of a man are you?
I'm 64 years old.
64.
I thought that it was necessary for me to bow, and I didn't think I'd miss it as much, but I don't think I'll ever be normal without going back around, you know, if it's not involved occupationally or whatever. I just got to be somewhere close to horse people and horses.
I know that. I've seen that, knowing you these last few months. I can just feel that in you. You're tied to that industry, right? In spite of the fact that you know your health condition doesn't allow you to do it, you just got to be somewhere. You got to be somewhere around, right?
Somewhere around.
Yeah.
That aspect is very sustaining.
I'm sure it is. I'm sure it is. The people that you work for, you know, I think maybe in some ways people who are class people are attracted to class people. And like you say, the people that you work for, the Mellons and the Vanderbilts and the people like that, are class people, but you're a class person too. And so therefore, class attracts class.
Thank you.
And everybody doesn't have that, you know. But everybody could have it if they wanted to have it. Because class doesn't come necessarily in terms of money. Some people falsely attribute class to money.
Oh, sure.
But it's the kind of person that a person is.
Yeah, I'd like to add to every trainer that I've worked for. To me, it's been an epitome of class.
You probably wouldn't work for them if they weren't, right?
I was fortunate enough to work for
right.
them.
Right,
like
right. Some of the jerks that you see around, there are some jerks who are trainers, I'm sure, right? Who treat people with disrespect. And particularly on the racetrack, you see people who are disrespectful of blacks just because they're blacks. But you never ran into that kind of stuff.
No, I never.
Yeah.
I've just been very fortunate.
That's wonderful. Very wonderful. Anything else you want to say about your career? Or any advice you'd like to give to?
I guess that's about it.
Is there anything you wish you could have done that you didn't do? Have you ever wanted to be an owner?
No.
No?
Too many heartbreaks. I can never withstand the heartbreaks that I see owners withstand, or trainers. I think that epitomizes class too, people who can withstand those things.
I see.
And I think only people who can withstand those things are the only people that blow it. But
I see. Because it's a chance thing, yeah. It's all about chance,
it's
right?
A challenge.
That's right.
Chance.
Yeah. And it's about winning too, isn't it?
Sure.
I know you said that to me earlier today.
Name of game winning.
You gotta win. Yeah. Well, thanks so much, Sam, for your patience.
You're quite welcome.
Also this time that you put in here, and I'm sure that this is gonna be a good tape that somebody can take and use later on. This goes to the museum, and probably somebody else will be interviewing you later on, but I was interviewing you here just in case they didn't get to you.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.